The following program is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund. Support for the distribution of this program is provided by National Public Radio member stations and the NPR Arts and Performance Fund. Contributors include the National Endowment for the Arts, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the H.J. Heinz Company Foundation. The Nature of Music series is produced by Garuda Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.
From Garuda Productions, The Nature of Music. In the modern world, we have devices which capture music and play it back for us. How do these devices affect the music we hear? Music boxes. Phonograph records.
Howdy, folks.
Radio.
Yes, it is your old friend.
Cassette tapes. I'm Paul Anthony. This time on The Nature of Music, we'll explore how these and other devices dramatically change our musical choices. Even change performer styles, change the sound of the music, and sometimes create a new art form. A Grammy Award-winning sound engineer tells us why he thinks less is better. An expert on early records says that young musicians are reviving old styles because of music preserved on old 78s. And if you consider music video a new art form, critic Michael Shore has a prediction.
All kinds of music will have access to this medium if they want to. You know, from jazz to classical to opera to country to folk to blues to whatever you can think of to Tibetan monk music, you know. If they want to make a video, let people see what the hell Tibetan monks look like making their music. Why not?
Whatever music we listen to, jazz, classical, opera, blues, folk, even Tibetan monk music, we usually listen to through some technological device. Even as early as 1640, a wealthy German burgher could play back his favorite tunes whenever he wanted, if he owned a mechanical spinet. This is an Octave Virginal, as its German inventor called it. It was made by a craftsman named Biedermann, who lived in Nuremberg, Germany, in the 17th century. You could call this one of the earliest surviving examples of a device for music storage and retrieval. Because this mechanical spinet was handcrafted, only a few people owned one, and the number of tunes each spinet could play was limited. 250 years later, Thomas Edison invented the phonograph, and for the first time, a mass audience had access to virtually endless musical choices. Just as Edison's invention was catching on, great numbers of immigrants were arriving in America. What happens when you put together a marvelous new machine, homesick immigrants, and American sales know-how?
The phonograph record. You could have something in your original language, folk songs, patriotic songs, maybe light opera melodies, things that you knew from home and were glad to have again.
Richard Spotswood probably knows as much as anyone about the ethnic 78 records made in the United States. He's just compiled a comprehensive discography of more than 200,000 titles of ethnic records on 78 that run the gamut from Albanian to West Indian music. In the late 1970s, young Jewish musicians searching for their ethnic roots revived the klezmer tradition of Jewish instrumental music. They listened to old 78s and rediscovered klezmer greats like clarinetist Naftula Brandwein, who came to America just before 1920.
The only thing we have that made that klezmer revival possible are these surviving phonograph records from that period, so that the young musicians could get an idea of style, of repertoire. One of the significant klezmer musicians was Naftule Brandwein. It might be too much to say he's assumed iconographic significance, but he's a person that the young klezmer musicians of today continually look back to, and you know, his songs are learned and his clarinet style is studied, and that's still considered the best way to approach that instrument in that idiom. Here's a tune Naftule made. It's called "Oi Tatas is Good." Daddy, that's good. And I think it means father rather than the sense of, you know, sugar daddies or red hot daddies.
Richard Spotswood says that ethnic records like this were marketed with the idea of selling lots of phonograph machines to the huge numbers of immigrant Americans. Further, as the notion of buying records became commonplace, the record producers found these same immigrants beginning to buy mainstream American records. Incidentally, this music by Naftule Brandwein was recorded in 1925 on an acoustic 78. To record acoustically, musicians and singers had to get as close as possible to the lily-shaped horn of the phonograph machine, which mechanically cut the record grooves. Spotswood says that Naftule was, in a way, bidding farewell to the acoustic method of recording, because just a few days after this record was made, RCA and Columbia introduced a new technology of microphones, tube amplifiers, and electric cutting heads.
Why must I live in dreams of the days I used to know?
Only with a microphone could you succeed with a style like this. Bing Crosby's intimate crooning was perfectly suited to the new microphones with his low, quiet, informal style.
Where the blue of the night meets the gold of the day, someone waits for me.
Bing Crosby was a major singing star on records and on stage. He sang with Paul Whiteman's orchestra and with his group, the Rhythm Boys, long before radio. But his great success on the radio was due to his understanding of the intimacy of that medium. Media historian J. Fred McDonald.
Kate Smith is another example in the 1930s of a woman who had certainly been a recording star and was known on the stage in the 20s, but when she comes to radio as the songbird of the South, as she was called in the late 20s, she flourishes, and indeed it is as a radio musical performer and a host of one of the most influential variety shows in the 1930s on network radio that Kate Smith enjoys great popularity.
Good evening, this is Ted Collins. It's 8:30 in New York, and time again for Kate Smith. Our guest tonight is that bright young Hollywood star, Lieutenant J.G. Gene Kelly, on leave from the United States Navy. But first, your hostess, Kate Smith.
I know a little bit about a lot of things, but I don't know enough about you.
Kate Smith, of course, was overwhelmingly popular, the most influential woman performer, I think, in the history of radio. Had some limited success in TV, hosting her own show in the early 50s, but then, you know, she was a much older woman by that time and didn't have quite the energies, and television wasn't as kind to her because she was a very large-framed woman.
Oh, what a stew I'm in, 'cause I don't know enough
about you.
Television, like all media, has its demands and rewards those who meet those demands. Kate Smith's style was a natural match for the medium of radio, and Bing Crosby's singing style made ideal use of the new microphones. But a medium can do more than provide entertainment.
I think radio does have a unifying, amalgamating influence as a mass medium in the process of creating the mass consumer market, which has been so necessary for the mass society we are. And I think the ability of somebody in the mountains of one rural state to be able to hear Pavarotti as well as somebody in the upscale northern suburbs of Chicago being able to hear a country fiddler, they all help to create an American music.
Jane Fred McDonald says further that radio now goes beyond national boundaries to connect people around the world.
The introduction, particularly by Japanese manufacturers, of cheap transistor radios into Asia in beginning in the middle 1960s, if not even a little earlier, I think has revolutionary potentials. I think the message that could be heard, the picking up of radio stations from regions outside even your own country. Shortwave radio is an interesting alternative, too. You can hear, listening to Radio Moscow, you can hear the music of Latvia, the music of Estonia, what's going on in local Turkestani music groups.
And, says McDonald, that's another example of a technology or device that offers the listener new musical choices. Earlier on this program, we heard Naftula Brandwein playing klezmer music on his clarinet. Back in 1925, the only job of the record producer was to get musicians to stand close up to the lily-shaped horn of the phonograph. The only way he could achieve a musical balance was to physically move performers closer to or further from the horn. Today, technology offers so many different ways of recording that the modern producer really must have a philosophy. The sound that producer wants to achieve determines the number of microphones used, where they are placed, and what happens to the recording on its way to becoming a disc. Jack Renner is a recording engineer and owner of Telarc Records.
We have got to present the ultimate listener with a concert hall experience. I use live music as a reference. A lot of people don't really know what live music sounds like.
Powerful piece of music and recorded many times. But in fact, this recording by Jack Renner of the Berlioz Requiem won several Grammy Awards in 1985, including one for Best Engineering. Renner says he uses the absolute minimum number of microphones to achieve what he considers a natural sound. I guess you could sum up his philosophy by saying that less is better.
I think that says it well. Yes, less is better. And the common and very standard approach throughout the world to recording classical music is to record this music with what I feel is an excessive number of microphones. It's not uncommon on a large orchestral session with a large company to see anywhere from 10, 20 to 30, I've seen as many as 40 microphones out on a standard symphony orchestra. My approach is a very standard minimal one, which is to put up three omni-microphones somewhere behind the conductor in the concert hall so that what we are hearing is a finished sound that has not been tampered with by the engineer or the producer on the session. one of the real trademarks of my recordings is this feeling that the performance is happening in an acoustic that is an integrated part of the performance itself, so that you have a good balance between the direct sound from the orchestra or whatever it may happen to be. It doesn't have to be an orchestra, it could be other things, and the acoustic of the hall itself. And I think they're one without the other is not a complete and finished sound.
In order to get what he calls a finished sound, Renner has to use a few tricks of the trade, as he did for the Berlioz Requiem in Atlanta's Symphony Hall.
We added 240 sheets of plywood to the hall to try to extend the reverb time and to add to the feeling of warmth within the hall itself. Wood does two things. It's reflective and it's absorptive at the same time, and it tends to add warmth to the sound along with a feeling of space. So we just simply cover most of the seats with plywood, and we will stand sheets of plywood on end along certain walls where we might get slapped depending on where the sound is originating from.
Whether or not Jack Renner tries to improve the hall acoustics by using sheets of plywood, his recording philosophy is the same: to use the absolute minimum number of microphones to achieve what he calls a concert hall experience. Now, if you listen to rock recordings, and we'll hear some later in this program, the singers and musicians are practically inside your head. That's because rock music is recorded with multiple and close miking, the opposite of Renner's philosophy. But you can choose any recording. The music you hear is filtered through the sensibilities of the producer and the audio engineer of that record.
Candeia, lembra que nós nos conhecemos numa roda de baixo do alto?
Me lembra, Alto.
Faz tempo, hein?
É, na festa da Penha.
Manda um aí.
Deixa comigo, vou levar.
Não vem, que assim não dá. Mas quem é você?
When I first went there, there were a couple of shortwave radios in the village, and all the Indians could do was basically listen to what somebody was playing in a city 1,000 miles away and consume what somebody else decided they could consume if they were going to listen to the radio at all. What they were listening to was mostly Brazilian music, and they only listened to music. Every time the news came on, they shifted channels because they didn't understand Portuguese, but they were fascinated by other people's music, including Brazilian's music.
Tony Seeger is an anthropologist at Indiana University who worked with the Suya tribespeople in the remote jungles of Mato Grosso, Brazil.
Now today, quite a few of them have cassette tape recorders, and they use those tape recorders quite differently because they can record what it is they want to record, and they can listen to what they want to listen to. And so people, when they go visiting, often carry with them tapes that they've recorded in their own village. When somebody comes to the village I was working in, for example, in an afternoon, they're called into the center of the village in the evening, and 15 years ago, they used to be asked to sing. But now they're asked to play some tapes that they've brought of the society they came from. And so instead of hearing one person singing, you hear what the whole village sounds like when it's singing away on a particular thing. And they'll often leave a tape or trade a tape of their singing for a tape of another group singing. And also, the cassette tape recorder means that the Suyas, their interest in other people's music can be constantly fed by exchanging tapes. So the cassette tape recorder is really different, it seems to me. The commercial implications of the cassette tape recorder are quite different because who controls the music? In this case, it's in fact the consumer, much more than the producer.
Anthropologist Tony Seeger, who continues his field research with the Suya people in Mato Grosso by providing them with blank cassettes in exchange for tapes they've recorded of their own music.
Dark in the city, night is a wild.
Every time a new technology is introduced into our lives, it affects our musical choices. It affects the musicians who perform in that medium. And sometimes a new technology creates a new form, like the music video. Michael Shore is the author of the Rolling Stone book of rock video. He says that the new medium of MTV, or music videos, made some groups successful who might otherwise have remained unknown in the United States, like this group, Duran Duran.
In 1981, August of 81, when MTV started, you know, they were pushing this band Duran Duran for a year or two before that, and they weren't going anywhere. They were touring doggedly. They were pretty. They were idols in Britain, but they weren't making it here for some reason. Then MTV came along. All of a sudden, in markets where MTV first opened, like Tulsa, Oklahoma, where one of the very first markets MTV ever played to, Capitol started getting field reports, people coming in a store saying, "Who's that band I saw on TV the other day, Duran something or other? You got their record here?" Sales surges in these markets, okay? Eventually, it picked up after a few months, and across the country, more and more Duran records getting bought. And finally, radio people look at the charts and go, "Who the hell are these guys? We haven't been playing them. Why aren't we playing them? Who are they? Oh, they're the ones that are on MTV. We better start playing them."
Music videos made Duran Duran a success. But other pop artists who were already famous, like Michael Jackson, found an audience on MTV who wanted to know more about their favorite singers. And so you have Michael Jackson producing several videos from hit songs like Thriller, Beat It, and Billie Jean.
Well, Billie Jean is the one you may have seen it where Michael Jackson is this guy who sort of, you know, he walks through a very stylized sidewalk sort of a set, and then he goes up into this tenement or something, and he's being followed by a photographer in a trench coat and a Borsellino hat and sunglasses who is obviously some kind of a private eye or something. And this private eye is always trying to take a picture of Michael Jackson. And every time he does, Michael Jackson vanishes, and then the picture comes out, and Michael Jackson isn't in the picture, you know. So, like, this guy cannot be caught on film. He's, like, superhuman or something like that. Wherever he walks, the, like, pieces of the sidewalk where his feet touch light up behind him, you know. And at the end of the video, after he gets away again from this guy who's tailing him, you don't see him, but you see the sidewalk light up in sequence. In other words, you know, oh, there he goes, getting away. He's invisible, but there he goes. There's his footsteps lighting up, you know, that kind of thing. So this was a really brilliant way of playing off of, you know, what everybody sort of subliminally perceived about Michael Jackson, that he was, like, possessed of extraordinary qualities, you know, that kind of a thing.
Shore says videos like Billie Jean can be enjoyed on their own, or can be read as one visual interpretation of the song. But remember Marshall McLuhan, who talked about hot and cool media? Rock music is hot. It makes you want to get up and dance when you hear it. But TV is a cool medium because we sit and passively watch it. So what happens when you put rock music on TV?
Well, I think what happens is that the cool medium douses the flame of the hot medium most of the time, at least in particular cases. If you go to a rock club, you know, where they have a video screen, now it's mandatory for all hip happening rock clubs to have their little video screen or their big video screen or their multiple monitor setup or whatever they have. What happens is that, you know, when a video that people want to watch comes on, they would generally, like, stop dancing and just stand there in the middle of the dance floor and watch the video. Yeah, I mean, I've seen it happen. I've done it. There's a club in New York called the Ritz, which is, like, one of the bigger clubs here. And I think I mentioned this in my book, actually. They have a huge, like, a 20, 30-foot diagonal screen. It's one of the biggest I've seen. Right around the time of, you know, Michael Jackson Mania, Beat It and everything, Beat It came on that screen. And let me tell you, it was a trip, as they used to say in the 60s. To stand there, you know, amidst a packed house of people on a Saturday night, and that came on, and you could just feel the rush of intensity in that crowd, you know, and everybody stopped dancing and just stood there, you know, the fists in the air, and yeah, you know, whatever. It was exciting. It was really thrilling, you know, to be in the middle of that kind of a phenomenon. It's so natural to turn your eyes to that screen and just see what the imagery is going to be, you know, and if you're bored by it, all right, you'll talk to your date, and you'll look back again 5 minutes later. Is anything exciting happening there now? You know, oh, look at that. You know. They told him, don't you ever come around here. Don't want to see your face, you better disappear. The fire's in their eyes, and their words are really clear. So beat it,
But Michael Shore is quick to point out that music videos won't be just rock videos anymore. The Windham Hill label, for example, has already put out ambient videos that combine pictures of mountain streams with quiet, soothing, Baroque jazz music. There's even a video of March to the Gallows by Berlioz, put out as a sort of classical music video. As Shore says, Tibetan chant? Why not? If you'd like a free program guide to the Nature of Music series, or information on how to order a cassette or a transcript of this program on music and technology, write to The Nature of Music, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. Here's that address again. The Nature of Music, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. Don't forget to mention the call letters of the station you are listening to and the title of this program, Music and Technology. Thanks to our contributors for this program, popular music historian Richard Spotswood, media historian J. Fred McDonald, audio engineer Jack Renner, anthropologist Anthony Seeger, and rock critic Michael Shore. Our program on music and technology is written and produced for Garuda Productions by Carl Signell and Deborah Jane Lamberton. Paul Blakemore is the mix engineer. Michael Wilpers is the research assistant. The executive producer for the series is Dr. Carl Signell. This series is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund. I'm Paul Anthony. This is NPR, National Public Radio.